I've grown up much of my life on a farm. My father has always been in agriculture, and I come from an agricultural state, the state of Iowa. Butt of 1,000 cruel and tasteless jokes. And I'd like to ask right now, how many of you are from farm somewhere in your background? Okay. Like you grew up on farms, or you farmed for a while, or who's farmed for a while? You farmed, Bill. Okay. All right. So I'm not speaking as an expert on farming, and I kind of hesitate to get up here as a young whippersnapper and tell you about farming. But we want to talk a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about the question: is there culture in agriculture? The answer to the question is yes. Agriculture is the basis and has been the basis for culture ever since culture originated. If you think back on biblical festivals, festivals of the harvest, festivals of the springtime planting, and the whole cycle of human civilization was for a long time related to how we related to the land. Many of the ancient gods of the pagans were related to fertility of the land and of the seasonal passage of time and the passing of the seasons. I want to talk today about a particular critique or criticism of culture and agriculture, and it's represented very well and probably best in a book by Wendell Berry called The Unsettling of America, a book on culture and agriculture. He's a proponent of a particular criticism of the way agriculture is practiced and the way culture is lived. He's not really clear about which has influenced which. But he says there is a crisis. The thesis is that the basis for culture, the word agriculture is significant, and it's significant that we in this day are talking more about agri-science or agribusiness rather than agriculture. Agriculture, in the original meaning of the word, had all sorts of things to do with the relationship to the land, the operation of a household, all the intricacies and connections between people producing things from the land and the health and harmony that was produced in agriculture. It says, through a combination of ideas and practices, agriculture has changed and our relationship to it has also. The result has been a society and a culture which is unhealthy because it's cut off and alienated from the source of life, the air and the ground out of which food grows. The result has been a society and culture of dismembered households, homes and families that have nothing to do when they're at home. All their interests and identities lie elsewhere. A society and culture of specialist lives and lifestyles, people knowing a lot about one thing, specializing in their lives, and as a result becoming easy victims of anxiety about how do I accomplish this or who do I get to do this for me, and especially victims of the interests of other specialists in which we dole out every parcel of our life to the attention of other specialists. We give our children to educational specialists. We give our health and our bodies to health specialists. We give our whole life is dispensed like that to other specialists. The result has been a society and a culture which has all but annihilated rural communities and culture. Rural towns and rural values have just about ceased to exist. What are left of them are surviving mainly because they've become urbanized. And the result has been a society and a culture whose agricultural practices are destroying the land's fertility and the productivity, not always by choice of the farmers. Make two points, and I'll just write them on the board here. We'll talk first of all about the exemplary farm. Exemplary farm and household. And then modern situation, and then I'll write it up here so you can hold me to it. We'll have a discussion. tendency is to talk so much that there's no time for discussion at the end. And so maybe I'll say we have 5 minutes to 11 right now, and for half an hour I will talk no more than half an hour. And there'll be times for questions. If the questions are better answered at the end, I'll ask you to just wait, and I'll take notes of the questions. Okay. All right. Now, the because I used the word exemplary or example, that's an important word for this whole concept. It isn't like the word this is the ideal or the model, because that is a word that doesn't fit with the practice of agriculture and household as Wendell Berry and others talk about it.
Does that mean traditional or typical? Because exemplary to me means ideal.
Okay, now he makes a distinction between the two. Ideal gives you all the facts that you need, and ideal is not tied to a particular place. He uses exemplary because when you talk about agriculture, you can only have examples of healthy farms. You can't have a model or an ideal. And you can only have examples because every farm will be different because it's a response to a particular place. No farm will be exactly like another one. And that's maybe one criticism you'd have of agriculture as it's practiced today. And the standard by which he talks about agriculture and culture is health. Not efficiency, not production, but health. Okay. A healthy farm, exemplary farm, a healthy farm is characterized, first of all, by that responsibility to place. It says, now, what that means is that you have chosen a place and said, this is it. You become a settled person. You choose your choices and your decisions on the farm and your activities. All of a sudden, you live with the consequences because you are in a settled place. Now, he says the main thing to characterize the two points of view about the modern understanding of farming and household and a more exemplary, a more healthy model is that the healthy model has an idea of this responsibility to place. The other model that he is speaking against has no responsibility to place. And he talks about it being irresponsible culture, one that's mobile, one that sort of has a conquistador mentality, that the world is there out there to exploit, always moving on to the new frontiers. And that has been the dominant point of view. He says there has always been another point of view, more subordinate, but it's the idea that this is the place. You know, I'm here, I'm going to move no further. This is my piece of turf. I'm going to take care of it, and I'm going to live with the consequences of what I do. Okay. So healthy farm is characterized, first of all, by responsibility to place. It's also characterized by kindly use. And that means basically preserving the fertility of the land indefinitely. That means you can continue farming in the same way indefinitely. And the land will stay healthy, it will stay fertile, the crops, the production of the crops will stay the same indefinitely. It's a sustainable kind of agriculture. Third, a healthy farm has a good deal of self-reliance. That means a lack of dependence. Farming today is the success and the policies of and practice of farming is dependent very much on what happens in the decisions of the oil cartel in the Middle East. You know, that the decisions made there have a lot to do with how farming is done and whether some farmers will go on and farm the next year or not. So a healthy farm is characterized by self-reliance, a lack of dependence upon things outside the farm. That has two results. One is you're not dependent upon international politics or government policies. You're also more able to be responsible in political behavior. If you find there are certain things that are unacceptable in the way the policy is practiced, you can exercise, because you're self-reliant, you can exercise a certain amount of restraint and responsibility, refuse to use certain products, cut back on your use of this or that, and you can exercise a political pressure that you cannot when you are totally dependent upon, that your operation is dependent upon imported or, you know, extra farm sort of supplies. Okay, self-reliance also means a diversity. Diversity used to be the mark of farms. Nowadays, monocultures are the rule for farms. Diversity used to allow the farm household to absorb the fluctuations of market and economy. That's not true anymore. The raising of one or two crops makes the farmer very dependent and anxious about the international scene and about what kind of grain deals are done. One move in international policy can ruin a farmer. All the eggs are in one basket, and a model of a healthy farm is that they're kind of spread out and there's a diversity. And most important, a healthy farm is characterized by a healthy, productive household. And this is where he begins to talk not only about farming culture, but about all the culture, every single household that we belong to. He talks about it refers to both rural and urban conceptions of household. And he talks a lot about the households, not just about the farming households, but about all the households we live in. The household is the building block of culture. And if you think about it for a little bit, that makes sense. It's where culture is made. It's where people learn their values. It's where they learn their hopes and dreams for life, what is important. It's also the place where culture is practiced. It's where people do their thing, and that's what culture is. And its importance, the household's importance to culture and agriculture is crucial. And I want to say this. It's not exactly an argument for the importance of the family, because Wendell Berry and others would say that you can have a family intact, but that does not make a healthy household. And he has many examples of that, and we'll get to that later. Okay, what is a healthy household? First of all, a healthy household is productive. Raw materials and resources enter the household. The farm household is the example. You know, the food that's raised comes in. It is processed and it is preserved. Farm family produces and stores and maintains its own food supply. There's also there are clothing, raw materials come in, you build buildings, utensils and tools, and household production used to include saleable stuff, a cottage industry, something that you were able to market in a small community. A healthy household is settled. Its members find their value and identity not miles away at work or on the football team or as a cheerleader, as kids do. Your identity and value is not found in your work that's out of town, 10, 15 miles away. Your identity is not found in the clubs you belong to, in the church you belong to even. Your identity is found in the work of the household and in your relationship to the land and the resources around it. It's settled, and it's close to the stuff of the earth. The food, the shelter, and the clothing. Again, you can see the interplay of household and farm there. A healthy household is self-reliant, able to weather swings in the economy. Their supply of food and the necessities of life are not totally dependent upon the money proxy, you know, having just a cash income. You know, if the economy all of a sudden cuts off a cash income in some households, there's panic and anxiety. It's a mark of maybe an unhealthy tendency that, a healthy household is able to weather the swings of that, and their diversity and their productivity, their exercise of restraint and responsibility enables them to get through hard times. Okay, that's a healthy household. Another characteristic of healthy household is responsibility. Since you're settled, since the healthy household is in a location and committed to a place, healthy household lives with the consequences of its actions. The consequences of much of your work is right there. The garbage you produce, you have to deal with it somehow. It isn't hauled away to some unknown site. Much of your recreation happens there at the household. It can't be irresponsible, tear up, spend a lot of energy, not dependent maybe on the car, the automobile. The consumption is what is consumed and the waste that's produced is dealt with in the place. Consequences in a responsible, healthy household are lived with. They're not just vented off into the air or put in a truck and hauled away someplace. A healthy household does not run on sexual energy alone. The marriage is not dependent for its intactness on the fact that there is a sexual relationship that's fulfilling between the two people. Now, that's not to say it's bad and not a necessary part, but work. The work of the household is the health of love. Work is the health of love. To have something in a partnership to do together is crucial to the health of the household. For people that work away from home, there's nothing to do when you come home except, home is where you come when you're not working or entertaining yourself. And for many people that work outside the home and have their identity in a full-time job, the home has very little to offer. The partnership of husband and wife is also, besides sexually, is also in the work that they do together, each with a productive and skillful part in the maintenance of the household. Kids, too, are engaged in useful work, and I think, contribute in very meaningful and very obvious ways to the health and operation of a healthy household. And a healthy household is finally a treasure of numerous skills and competencies. They're not just specialists, but they know how to produce and preserve food. They know a little bit about building, about the maintenance of the household. They're skilled in economic management. The word ekonomos is a word talking about the management of the household. The ecology of the nomos, is that the right word? Yeah, nomos, the home. It's the nomos, the law of the oikos. That's what it is, the law of the house. Yeah. You Greek scholars can correct me when I make mistakes like that. The oikonomos is... In the New Testament, you see stewardship, it's really oikonomos, which means the law of the house. Okay. So it was a very household-oriented word. And the other examples of the skills and competencies include the maintenance of the family's health to a great extent, recreation, the artistry, producing the art, the music. The rural communities used to have their own artists and musicians, and that's, sit around on the stove after the work was done and get out the mandolin and the jug band, and that's not done anymore. The stereo is there, and we're dependent upon specialists that produce our music. Yeah.
Can I back up
to
that word again?
Economics?
Some study on
that. Yeah. Okay, and I think maybe it's
like a blueprint?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe an example of, and it may be indicative of the situation we find ourselves in, that the word that used to have such a breadth of meaning in talking about the household, the plan for creation, has now come to mean something very specialized in dealing with money. Yeah, economics. Okay, all right. That's the other skills and competencies include the mechanical skills. You had to be fairly good at fixing things, and nowadays people panic when the toaster's broken, or you go out and buy a new one. Animal husbandry, and you either had to be a pretty good meteorologist, be able to read the weather and respond to it. There were all sorts of skills that made life fun in dealing with the stuff of life in a healthy household. All right. Talked about exemplary farm and household. The most important element in a healthy farm was a healthy household. And a healthy household is not necessarily attached to a farm. It could be associated with a small community. It could even be in a large urban area. But all the aspects the health of the household we've talked about would be there. And it's interesting that there are many, many projects that are seeking to put health back into the household in that way and actually creating little urban farms The Farallones Institute in San Francisco does that. They have taken a house and an experiment and made it as self-sufficient as possible, a house in downtown San Francisco. And they raise bees and fish in the backyard and rabbits for food, and they have crops instead of a lawn. It's a fascinating sort of project. And there are many, many people who have organized to bring the values of the household into urban living and become less dependent and more self-reliant in the true healthy household. Wholeness and holy, yeah. In other words, are hail and hearty.
All of them.
Okay, good. Okay, any questions on that so far? Talking about the exemplary farm and household.
Do I understand you correctly? What you're really talking about is the traditional farm of two generations ago, where they had cows for milk and pigs for meat and chickens and eggs in a garden and an orchard, instead of just having a house out on the farm and a grain field, and they buy all their groceries and meats in town.
Okay. Am I talking about farms two generations ago? I think in a certain sense, yes, that they had maybe a better understanding of what was healthy. However, that was the same farm household that had in it kind of the elements of what developed into our modern agriculture. I think proponents would say, no, we're not talking about just going back. We're talking about certain values that were present and maybe more obvious two generations ago, but have somehow been subordinated to other values like production, efficiency, income, and need to be re-established. And would be a movement toward health. So yeah, they maybe are more exemplary, but they still had probably in them the seeds of modern day agriculture and some probably unsound practices.
I'm going to follow that through and say, is that then translated into the urban household, which likes to have a garden and a fruit tree in the background, and where they're do-it-yourselfers, and the family tends to be artistic and creative? Is that a translation from the rural seen into the urban scene?
Possibly. And I think the proponents of this, if you're talking about having a big spread or a hobby farm, the proponents of this still have some problems with this, because it brings in maybe the easiest parts and some of the advantages, some of the romanticism about being in touch with the land and having your own little two-acre farm, but some of the responsibilities don't come with it.
Talking about the house and lot in the city with a garden corner and an apple tree, and where the husband's a great do-it-yourselfer and the wife tends to get interested in creative arts.
Yeah. Oh, well, okay.
Maybe they put in a solar heating.
Okay. What you're saying is true, that there's probably a carryover, that people have an urge to be in touch with those sorts of things. Whether it's a real effective way or a real responsible way to do it, there's some question about that.
I guess there were kind of two points that occurred to me as you were going through it. It sounded to me like your farm description was pretty specific to what I remember from my childhood in the Midwest.
Uh-huh.
For instance, if I were speaking of the Amazon basin in Brazil, where your soil is subject to lateralization, it's a completely different situation.
What is lateralization?
Okay, lateralization is where you clear the land, and if you farm it for more than a year or two, it turns to rock. Mm-hmm. Literally, it turns to rock because of very heavy tropical rains. And so what they do there is they practice slash and burn agriculture. They clear a land, they farm it for a couple of years, and they let it lie fallow. Jungle comes in and reclaims it, and they move on to another piece. I suspect that the concept that you were speaking about would apply also there if you broaden it from the immediate land that is occupied to a regional area. And there's a certain carrying capability for a region.
Yeah.
As opposed to, 10 acres or 20 acres or so.
Mm-hmm. I think the criteria to apply to that is not are they doing it like we do it in America, but is it healthy for the land? Does it maintain the productivity of it? Is it kindly use of that land?
The other thing is that I think that, at least I found in my own mind, an equating the household with the family, and I would be more comfortable if the household were equated with the community. And I'm thinking of Horace's Holden.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are many gifts here at Holden, and people serve at their level. I don't know what the exact number is, but a fraction, less than, say, 5% of the population of this country raises the food,
mm-hmm.
which we all need. And you would say, well, this is a departure from the exemplary farm and household concept. In a sense, I agree, but in a sense, it allows us to allow people to specialize in areas where they can serve. And I, you know, somehow it lifts my spirit to be a part of Man on the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that in a sense is an exploration, an extension of my spirit, which allows me to grow vicariously, if you will. Mm-hmm. Now, it's pretty clear there isn't a farm on the moon. And those guys are probably not collecting eggs every morning. And so the kind of specialization which allows you as a pastor to serve in a certain way, allows me to serve in my way, I think is something that we don't necessarily want to set aside.
Okay, well, other response?
Well, you know, the emphasis for years though has been on specialization. The ideal from an agribusiness standpoint farm would be known and closed, and one person, or maybe even nobody, regulating the machinery at a certain period of time in order to do thus and thus the very most efficiently possible. Eliminate people entirely. It seems to me that we have to have an emphasis away from specialization. We can still be interested on men and women, but we become so much more vulnerable when we're so specialized. We have such a narrow outlook on things, I think, as we become more and more specialized.
Let me submit that vulnerable is one way to explain it. I think that's been the emphasis so far. But in a community sense, we become interdependent.
Mm-hmm. That's a good word.
Interdependent, and I think that's a very positive concept.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right, and I don't want to give the impression that that this movement is advocating farms that say that hell with the rest of the world, we will live our own life. Interdependence is a good way to talk about it, but there are two issues that are crucial to that. One is scale. There has to be a very obvious connection for all communities to the land. And the fact that the land is where they derive the stuff of life. Let me just say that much. It's the concept of farm does not mean that it's all centered in one family. The idea of a community of a household being made up of non-related people is another way. But somehow, the thing that's happening with the specialist view nowadays is the connection with the land is lost, and the consequences have been monumental because of that.
The first thing I want to say is that what you are proposing, or what Wendell Baring has written, is a blend. Well, he's expressing his feeling about a particular social system.
Mm-hmm.
A social system is made up of two elements, the society, the social, the group itself, and then economics. You've got, in a sense here, two in conflict. The society he is speaking about is in conflict with economics. What has happened to the American agricultural past is a response to our economic system. Good or bad, this is what determines what is going to happen to agriculture.
Yeah.
Probably as much as anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have the book too, and he's a good writer.
Uh-huh.
Except he builds a lot of his arguments on pure and simple fallacy.
Well,
he does point
that out. I mean, he has some things to say about it, about the origins of our country and economic system, and he does acknowledge there is that problem. He says that what has happened is that Thomas Jefferson, one of the framers of our Constitution and the visionary of our what our culture would look like, had the idea that we would be a nation of gentlemen farmers, that we would be small households, responsible citizens because we had a stake in the existence of the land. And that was Thomas Jefferson's vision. He says, on the other hand, Alexander Hamilton was the one that established our economic system and the system of banks, and they, he admits, are in conflict. Jefferson's vision of the gentleman farmer, a nation of farming households, is in conflict with Alexander Hamilton's idea of the free market. And those who sell best and cheapest will be the successful ones. He really would advocate changes in the economic system.
And push you in the modern situation. I don't want to deal with that now. I don't want to get caught in discussion without getting that piece in there, because I think there's more I want to hear what you have to say.
Okay. I think the result is that we have an economic system that rewards the efficient producer, the large producer, and that really works against the small producer, the small farmer. And the economic realities of the situation make the kind of the situation he calls exemplary impossible. And he admits that the answers and the solution is as yet unthinkable. That does not yet change the fact that he thinks we have a real crisis on our hands. And the crisis may be set in as a conflict between our economic system and our relation to the land. Very good.
One of the ways to attain this, there's been a number of people like Schumacher who's written about living better with less. It's possible to reach the more exemplary household situation if you're willing to live with less gadgets and automobiles and less dependence on television sets and travelers or whatever. A lot of these other things, if you're willing to cut down on some of these things, then it's possible to reach closer to this other level.
That makes good sense for those of us that belong to the consuming era. But try to sell that in West Oakland, where they have been living with less, and they don't want to continue to live with less.
Mm-hmm.
They want to have a life expectancy which approaches ours.
This is the same problem with the third and fourth world.
That's right.
They want to emulate us.
Well,
but the people that, for example, I mentioned Joel, there was some agricultural economists that went to China, and they had a fantastically efficient program of growing, rotating crops and raising fish and so forth. Very, very efficient, and these economists were very impressed. The Chinese could not understand why they would be interested at all in what they were doing.
But they were all on a large scale. Single.
To a point, they didn't transport things from one end of China to the other.
See, we're talking about a farm from day one, the biblical times. And it's never been true in actual life.
Well, I don't know. They have communities.
Yes.
That,
what I meant is, you always have to have interaction. He was talking about agriculture, machinery, artificial climate. In fact, you mentioned nobody would really have to run.
That would be the ideal.
But a man could have one of those and starve to death. Because he couldn't raise all what he needed under those one conditions that he would have. What I'm saying, back in biblical times, everybody didn't plant wheat or grain.
Right.
They had their vineyards. The winemaker made his wine and he prayed. And the only reason why money developed was it was easier to carry the money than the jugs of wine. I mean, it's as simple as that if you want to go back to the basics. But no place in our history has a family been really self-sufficient.
Well, I think some of the pioneers.
Oh, they always depended on their neighbors.
Okay. Dependence on neighbors is not the same as dependence upon a system, a national system of transportation and money by proxy, you know, a huge market, international market of exchange. It's qualitatively different when you get to that scale. Because when you deal with your neighbors, you still live with the consequences of your action. You don't sell your neighbor. soybeans full of corn. Because your neighbor sells you other things, and because you have to live with your neighbor and sit in the same pew with your neighbor in church. Okay? There is a certain amount of living with the consequence and responsibility that can go on, even in a small interdependent thing that you do not have in larger economic systems.
Well, there was a concept which was current a few years back called the global village concept, which talked again about this interdependence, where it does matter to me here in Holden what happens down in Western Europe, or what happens in China, or what happens in Indonesia, because we are all one family.
If that whole mindset is maintainable, that's beautiful. Wendell Berry says he doesn't have a whole lot of time for the term global village, because sometime, somewhere, you've got to be specific. You've got to get into a place and say, this is where I'm going to be responsible. And it's possible for people with the idea of a global village to be thinking in global terms and still be very irresponsible at home.
Well, we are getting much of our chromium, for instance, from Central Africa. Okay, in that sense, we are depending on them for that material, which is used to harden our steels and things like that. Conversely, we are, because of our agriculture, helping them out with their crops, for instance.
Yeah, that's the question. Are we really helping?
There are some that would say no.
I guess my only point in bringing it up was to say that we are interdependent now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think on a large scale, it's a little different. That's all I want to say. On a large scale, it's different, and it's good to have it. But I think his argument is specifically about the small scale, and that's what he's talking about.
I think it's important you brought up the consequence of action, and also somebody mentioned the pricing. I think the thing that really disturbed me and has disturbed me for 40 years has to do with soil loss. And there have been a lot of papers now examining soil loss. And one of the recent ones has to do with, they've been done in Wisconsin. There was an article in Science in the last few years by Brayton's associate. Perrenthal has done this. And in third world countries, they've looked at it. Now, here in our country, just to recall for you some of these studies, and this should frighten you. And I hope it frightens us into action. Until we price so that if you sell your corn or your wheat, the price includes the soil you lost growing per bushel of soil lost. At a time when in Wisconsin, for all the row crops on the slope, they're losing soil at a rate twice as fast as what's consistent with permanent agriculture. In Iowa, in some places, they're losing it up to 50 tons per acre. I can take you to the Blues Country where I live. It grows more wheat than any other county probably in the world, at least up until a recent past. There are some steep slopes that are losing it up to 100 tons per acre. We are losing ground in this, and when we lose our soil, we've lost it. And until we look at the pricing system, and as you mentioned, Joel, the consequence of our action, we're destined to oblivion.
And we sacrifice husbandry for economic gain, which is really dubious.
Well, I want to spend just a little time. Well, we're going to talk about that here. Farmers, I haven't really made it through the outline yet to the discussion. That's all right. We'll talk about who's to blame for the situation of farming, and I just want to say at the outset, it's not the farmers exclusively. Present situation in the household, and see if you can relate to some of these things or have experienced them. I know I have. First of all, is characterized by, this is a hard word, vagrancy. You know, nobody's home. Home is only where you come when you don't have anything to do. We are responsible to no place. We live our lives over 50, 60 mile area, you know, in our cars and automobiles. Mobility rather than a commitment to a place and settledness, characterizes the unhealthy household. Because of that, the household is irresponsible. No consequences are felt at home. The work you do, the decisions you make at work, have consequences on people, you know, further on down the line. An executive in a company makes decisions, and the decisions are transferred to the opposite coast, and the manufacturing or the disposal of waste goes on there 2,000, 2,500 miles from home. And even if they're done at work, you can drive the 15 miles home and not live with the consequences. The same thing is true of kids. You know, the kids, their action and behavior is all outside the home. You can come home and not live with the consequences. That's the same thing is true of our consumption and recreation. Our waste and garbage is all hauled off. Our fumes and poisons are just dispensed into the air. Do not live with the consequences. Another mark of an unhealthy household is that it's specialist and not diverse. The household, the head of the household brings home, the traditional role is the man works outside the home. The specialist comes home, there's nothing left to do except the old, the token agricultural of mowing the grass and help with the housework. Housework, which at one time was full of skill and competencies, as varied as farming was, being able to produce food, to be able to maintain the health, is now reduced to proper consumption. I mean, being a good budgeter of the family market, you go to the grocery store, you buy this, you know, it's been reduced totally to consumption, and marketing has victimized the housewife at home by telling her that, making her anxious and say that the work is something to be avoided and got out of. You want convenience so you can run off and play tennis or look beautiful. There is a built-in disregard for human energy, labor-saving device. You know, the use of human energy is drudgery, and one seeks to not have to exert yourself. And it's interesting that we end up with this schizophrenic idea that we want to be slim and beautiful and young and healthy, but we don't want to work and exercise our body. We want to be people of leisure and healthiness. And the two just cannot be achieved with the avoidance of human labor. Three, we are become victims of anxiety and victimization. Anything that breaks, anything that goes wrong becomes the responsibility of a specialist. We drive in to have our car fixed, and we wonder, if they saw us coming, we're going to get taken to the cleaners. There is hardly any aspect of life that does not have that fear of victimization. And that's not interdependence, like it would be in a small community. That's dependence. That is a very unhealthy sort of relationship between people. You cannot depend upon the integrity of the people you deal with in that sort of a situation where you've totally dispensed or disregarded your own, you become a specialist and you depend on other specialists for every compartment of your life. Our kids are entrusted to education specialists, we're entrusted to health, our health is entrusted to health specialists, our car to car specialists, our toaster to toast specialists, our rugs to rug specialists, our chimney to fireplace specialists. You know, there is so much cause for anxiety about being victimized there that it's not healthy. Another thing is that due to the marketing of products that we consume and turn to waste and garbage in our household, there is the built-in panic of being up to date. You know, the built-in panic, if consumption is the only activity of the household, the only thing it makes for proper consumption and good consumption, the only standard by which you can consume is the most up-to-date. And you can never be up-to-date unless you own tomorrow's product today. And there's a built-in anxiety for it because as soon as you've bought it, someone will have the new model. There's a built-in anxiety about how we look. Instead of going with the standard of health, we go with the standard of a model. And we see these people, they're told that men shouldn't be bald or overweight, and they should all have broad shoulders and slender hips. women are told to look like the people on the covers of the magazines or in the car, cigarette advertisements, and they're told never to look old. You know, men and women are never supposed to look old, and they're all supposed to look good in a bathing suit. That does nothing but produce anxiety. And the cure is as bad as the disease, and that is that we consume in order to find the cure for our not living up to the model. The household, this is a very, he has a whole chapter in his book on the body and the earth. The household is run on sexual energy alone. Because there is not the work, the productive work in the household, the health of the household depends on do you love me, or yes I do, or on your sex life. And we are taught all sorts of illusions about what married life should be like. We should always be seeing, you know, sex always means hearing bells and seeing stars and having the, you know, this torrid love affair going through 50, 60 years of marriage. And when it doesn't happen, people think marriage is a failure. It's not true. The chapter, I can recommend it to you and say it's excellent. It has to be read to be appreciated. The household, once it has taken on this character, especially where the household was still connected with the land, has of course changed agriculture. And mainly in two ways. The household has become dependent. A farm will fold because of a decision made in Libya about the price of gasoline, dependent upon all this imported technology and resources. And it's possible that farm families without their automobile would starve. I knew people in Iowa that put 3, 4, 5 trips on the car a day into town to buy groceries, to go to school, that sort of thing. The dependence on the automobile, there's very few farmers, well, fewer than you would expect, that raise gardens and supply much of their food for their household. And the other thing is that what has resulted is the farmers become specialists in business and in a kind of agri-science. And they have not practiced kindly use. They have not preserved the fertility of the land. As Leo said, they have gone at it like mining, extracting the fertility and not replacing it. And the cost in topsoil and fertility has been tremendous. Now I've gotten to the point. Farmers have not produced this kind of farming. Farmers are not the ones solely to blame for it. It's a specialist mindset, infatuation with the machine, with cheap energy, and with the future, and with the idea of model efficiency. The economic system has dictated that farms be farmed to maximum production. Wendell Berry especially, Leo, are you still here? He went out at the right time. He indicts farm experts at agricultural colleges. And he indicts agribusiness manufacturers and suppliers as a sort of a coalition which have sold a model of farming that's high in capital and based on efficiency. And I know from conversations with the Bishop of Iowa, L. David Brown, writer of the book Take Care, he's very interested in agricultural issues. He says the farmers in Iowa are very frustrated with this model of industrialized agriculture. It's been sold to them, and they have bought it, although now it threatens the fertility of their land and losing a bushel of topsoil per acre, a bushel of topsoil for every bushel of corn. It's unthinkable to think about that sort of a loss, and losses in inches per year, and it takes thousands of years to make an inch. The loss of the fertility of their land and the solvency of their operation. Some can't afford to farm or to pass their farm on to their children. And the only way they can afford to farm is because every year the value of their land goes up and they can borrow more money. The way farming operations go, they operate 3, 4, 5 years at a loss, but because the valuation of their land goes up, they can achieve a greater loan. And farming will end instantly for farmers the day that the bottom drops out of the land market. Today it isn't worth $4,000 or $5,000 more, or $1,000 more an acre the year after a bad year. Farmers who 30 years ago began farming a section of land as a square mile are now millionaires on paper and can be indebted at that rate, and at an increasing rate. But the frustration of the farmers is great, and L. David Brown convened a meeting between farm experts at Iowa State and farmers, and the farmers just were angry as hell at the model of agriculture that was being sold to them. Their kids couldn't continue to farm. They couldn't continue to farm. One more bad year and a bad market and the land would put them out of business. And they were laying much of the blame at the door of specialists in agriculture.
You know, the same thing, though, is in education and health care. Look at the burnout of teachers and among nurses and doctors and so forth. It's the same, you're not a teacher anymore. You're a teacher of 7th grade English to 150 kids a day. And you didn't have it last year. You're not going to have it next year. And another bill's coming. And the same thing with nurses and doctors and so forth. This is a cancer, I think, this whole thing that's spread throughout our society.
Can we put this in the kind of a context where we talk about how, back to this earlier comment about stewardship. The question is, why are we teaching the 7th grade class? Why are we in medicine? Why are we in science? Why are we in farming? And if we are stewards of what the Lord has given us, that I think is where we have to put the emphasis.
The emphasis on health, the health of the creation.
Not only that, but in a related sense, we talked about responsibility to our local environment, particularly for the farmer. The tax laws are such that a farmer cannot pass his farm on to his children. You just cannot do it because it has such an inflated price, the inheritance taxes are going
to. You have to sell the farm to pay the tax on the inheritance. Yeah.
So the sense of continuity. Grandfather, the father, the son, the grandson.
And all the skills that go along with that.
Does not
pertain. Yeah. Okay, yeah, the word health and stewardship, very important there. And that brings up the fact that not only, farmers and agricultural experts are not the only people that have helped bring about this change in farming. It is especially caused by our own disregard of agricultural issues. We've looked at food production as drudgery. It's been assigned, and the status of food producers has been assigned to the lowest class of people. And the poor farm workers have been the last to unionize and to come to a point where they can get what they feel is a decent wage. We have had a one-sided interest in food, and that is that we are interested only in the price and secondarily the quality of food. And we have not been concerned about the issues of the cost to the fertility of the land in the food that's produced. We have not asked the question, which is a legitimate question, should we eat oranges in January when it has such a great cost having the monoculture of oranges in California and the kind of production of those kinds of crops so that we in the Northlands can eat a super varied diet through the winter months? We've asked mainly the question of price and quality and variety. We've also had this, it really bugs me being from Iowa, we've also had an urban bias. We have a specialist mentality, and farmers and farming and farmland states are always the butt of jokes. You know, how many jokes have you heard about Iowa and corn and pigs and South Dakota, Yeah, jokes or just because people are from there. Yeah, yeah.
Some of your best people.
Okay, the conclusion, and we've got about 10 minutes for discussion, is that the condition of agriculture and culture is unhealthy. Barry sees it, and the movement sees it as rather a desperate situation. We are in danger of turning our land into a desert and our culture and character into a desert with it. I'll just read the last page of the book. In Michigan, in the fall of 1975, a fire retardant chemical known as PBB was mistaken for a trace mineral and mixed into a large order of livestock feed. This feed was sent to four Michigan mills run by the Farm Bureau, and from there it went to farms and to the stock troughs. The resulting contamination of meat, milk, and eggs produced a disaster which is still continuing after 3.5 years, and the limit of which are not known. The immediate and most noticeable result was a state program to destroy contaminated animals and food products. This did away with about 1.5 million chickens, 29,000 heads of cattle, 5,900 hogs, 1,470 sheep, 2,600 pounds of butter, 18,000 pounds of cheese, 34,000 pounds of dry milk products, and 5 million eggs. But many people were also affected, some seriously, and the long-term effect on human scale are not known. This was a tragedy, personal and economic, private and public, caused by one error that may have been as simple as pulling the wrong lever. And we must recognize that both in its carelessness and in its magnitude, this tragedy is characteristic of an agriculture, indeed of a culture, without margins. Margins is a word he uses, we didn't talk about it, but is related to the carrying capacity of the land, leaving some things alone and not doing things just because we can do them. It is a highly centralized and industrialized food supply system that there, in such a system, there can be no small disaster. Whether it be a production error or a corn blight, the disaster is not foreseen until it exists. It is not recognized until it is widespread. By contrast, a highly diversified small farm agriculture combined with local marketing is literally crisscrossed with margins, and these margins will work both to allow and encourage care and to contain damage. But such an agriculture would do more than provide us with protective margins. In reducing industrial uniformity, it would give us a new sense of our real unity, our common sharing in the good of health. It is a rule, apparently, that whatever is divided must compete. We have been wrong to believe that competition invariably results in the triumph of the best. Divided body and soul, man and woman, producer and consumer, nature and technology, city and country are thrown into competition with one another. And none of these competitions is ever resolved in the triumph of one competitor, but only in the exhaustion of both. For our healing, we have on our side one great force, the power of creation, with good care and with kindly use to heal itself. Okay. That's quarter to 12. We eat in 5 minutes. We did have a lot of discussion in between, but we do have it on the outline yet.
At this point, I'm going to risk exposing myself. I'm one of these so-called agricultural experts.
So is my father.
I represent Land-Grant University, and without going into a lot of detail, I'm going to make this statement, and I'll discuss it with anybody, that I still think that Land-Grant University is one of the greatest institutions that ever hit this country. It did the most for agriculture of any other institution. And we don't realize it, but we are the recipients of benefit that we don't realize where they came from. Much of it came from the Land-Grant University. Mm-hmm. And the problem with agriculture is to a large extent, a result of what has happened in agriculture is a result of economics. It's the things that you and I want, it's what the public want. They want an economic system that drives the price of food down. And that's a policy. That's maybe not a policy in terms of a law, but it's a policy by default. It's the way we operate. It drives it that way.
Okay, and I appreciate that point. My father...
Unless Leo was here, he could do it.
I just wanted to say it because it's he himself teaches at an agricultural school in Kentucky.
And he's an English teacher, I know, I've met him. He's an English teacher, part-time English teacher at the University of Kentucky.
And I would imagine his frustration or the things that he expresses about agricultural schools comes from personal experience in Kentucky. My father reminds me, too, that there was never a time when farming was practiced with as much knowledge as it is now. And we have the Land-Grant University to thank for that. It is also the intention of the Land-Grant University to aid farming, and it has done that. The problem that he identifies is that somehow the pressure has been on to promote, maybe through the economic system, to promote a very large-scale farming.
Agriculture has been benefited, and the rest of society has taken advantage of that benefit and used it in other ways.
Okay, so it's not a return to agricultural expert-less agriculture, but it's the idea of capturing values and using our knowledge and expertise in agriculture to achieve a new...
This is the other thing about the book. He is denigrating the advances that have been made. It's a very thing that we need to support ourselves and the rest of the world. For example, I remember back in the 30s, the U.S. production of wheat was 800 million bushels. This year it was 2,700,000,000. Mm-hmm. Now, last night we had a meeting here about feeding people, feeding the world. Do you want to go back to the 30s when we can produce only 800 million bushels a week?
There is one problem with that argument. If we are producing food carelessly to feed the world's poor, that does not mean go on producing food more carelessly than before.
I can tell you something else. I'm in the area. My area is soil science. I'm a state extension specialist in soils at Washington State University. That because of the economics that farmers have to operate under, they cannot afford to use the most efficient practices in running their land. The whole basis for their farming is to make a living. They've got to make money to make a living. That means sometimes not using the most up-to-date practices. Or I shouldn't say the most up-to-date.
But the most conservative.
Those that are most efficient in terms of use of resources.
And the ones that maintain.
There may be no more knowledge, but I feel that it's spread very, very thin, where it used to be very deep, where everybody used to have knowledge. Now it's really thin.
No, I was on the farm back in the 30s. I worked with farmers then.
His farmer is fiction.
This is right.
Well,
I don't care.
Wendell Berry is the son of a lawyer.
Okay, he never says, he talks about competencies and values that are helpful to a sustainable agriculture. And I hear what you're saying is that both agricultural expert and farmer are bound by an economic system that works against preserving fertility.
Well, this is part of it.
Okay, and I understand that, and I appreciate hearing a person connected with the agricultural teaching institutions to be able to identify that it's not fair to lay the blame at your doorstep. Yeah, and I might hear that from my father, too, and he's...
The blame is so much more diverse than what he is pointing that we don't really get a concept of it from his book. It's a very narrow, very biased viewpoint.
Well,
he's right to some extent.
Okay, I think the reason that he speaks so polemically as he does is because he feels the situation is really critical.
It is.
And the way I read it, I think the blame is laid most of all at the doorsteps of the citizens.
And that's what I said.
It's the public.
This is right.
Demand for things.
Yeah.
As long as demand there, we try to meet.
Right. It dictates as much the policy of the college as it does the farming practices.